brought to you by the Computer History Museum.
You're listening to CHM Live Radio. I'm Chanel Lauren, and I produce the museum's live speaker series. Each year, we bring incredible guests to the museum to talk about computing and the transformational effects it's having on our society. We've hosted a wide range of conversations, from geneticists and asteroid miners to technology giants like Elon Musk and Sheryl Sandberg. Today's episode features Rana El Khalioubi, the CEO of Affectiva. Through a combination of psychology, technology, and cognitive science, her company is bringing emotional intelligence to the digital world.
We're building technology that's not just going to make computers better, it has the potential to help, you know, humans communicate better.
Affectiva creates algorithms that train computers to recognize facial expressions and identify emotions connected to things like wide eyes, raised eyebrows, or smiles. So, how did Rana invent this technology? Who is using it? And what could a future filled with emotion-aware devices look like? Find out in this conversation between Affectiva's Rana El Khalioubi and former museum CEO John Haller. It was recorded in June of 2017.
Well, we're going to talk to you a little bit about how you got started, because you have such an interesting personal story, and it kind of helps set the stage for everything that you're doing now. So talk a little bit, if you would, about growing up in Egypt and how you got your start.
Yeah, so I grew up in the Middle East, and I'm Egyptian-American. But I grew up in the Middle East and studied computer science as an undergraduate. And I was particularly interested in kind of the human-computer interaction aspects of computing, as opposed to, like, you know, the operating system parts. I was just really intrigued by how technology was affecting and transforming how we connect with each other as humans. And then I got an opportunity to go to Cambridge University to do my PhD. And it was my first experience abroad, away from my family. And I remember when I got there, I was spending more time with my laptop than I was with any other human being, which is sad. I don't think I'm the only one, though. But it made me recognize that this computer, even though we're very intimate and we're spending so much time together, it had absolutely no clue how I was feeling. And I started to obsess with this idea that, what if computers could recognize human emotions just like my best friend would or my mom would? Mm. And then, of course, the key insight was that our relationship with technology was really transforming. You know, it's becoming a lot more perceptual. It's becoming a lot more relational. We're attached to our devices.
What was happening in the human-computer interface area at that time that made you see the potential of this?
So this was in the early 2000s, and, you know, we had the big Logitech webcams, which were blurry and they were super slow. But you could see that, you know, cameras are going to become ubiquitous. You could also see that this idea that computers are our portal to communicating with the rest of the world. I used to use ICQ. I don't know how many people here remember that. And again, that was my way of communicating back home. And actually, I remember, like, there were days when I was really homesick and I was in tears, and the only thing I could use to communicate my emotions was like an emoji with tears, right? And I felt like we could do better.
There was something else that a computer could do to help you. To help you connect emotionally? Was it a connection thing, or was it a perception thing? How would you describe the specific way you wanted to get into the emotional aspect of it?
I think it was because I remember, like, being, you know, stressed because I have a paper deadline and I'd be working on the paper, and then, you know, Clippy? How many people remember Microsoft Clippy?
Oh, right? Yeah.
It would pop up and, like, do this little twirl and say, "It looks like you're writing a letter." I'm like, "No, I'm not." So that was a piece of it.
Yeah. You may be one of the first advanced scientists in the field who was inspired by Clippy.
Yeah, I guess
that's,
I was.
That's really great. Now, I mentioned in the introduction that autism mm-hmm. has played an important role in your long arc of work in this so far. Why is that, and how did that happen?
So when I first got to Cambridge University, I started exploring how do people communicate emotion. And obviously, as humans, we express emotion in a number of ways, through our gestures and our face and our voice. But I was particularly fascinated by people's, you know, facial expressions. And I remember the first talk I gave at Cambridge, I actually started with my back to the audience, and it was really awkward, but I wanted to drive the point home that, you know, our facial expressions are a fundamental aspect of how we connect. Hmm. And after the talk, this guy in the audience raised his hand and he said, you know, this sounds like autism. You're trying to teach a computer how to read emotions. My brother has autism. You should look into that. And I did not know what autism was. This is, again, you know, 17 years ago. And I said, well, can you spell that? Took a note. And it turns out Cambridge has one of the top autism research centers. And I hooked up with that center. And at the time, they were building an emotion repository to help kids with autism read emotions.
Now, what does that mean, an emotional repository?
So they had examples of people expressing, like, over 400 different types of emotions. Mm. And through voice and through face, as a tool to help, you know, kids on the spectrum learn about how do people communicate emotions. And I said, well, could I use that same data set to train my algorithms? Mm. So that was the initial kind of, you know, the connection. And then I realized we're building technology that's not just gonna make computers better, it has the potential to help, you know, humans communicate better. And the analogy I like to give is, you know, when you have a hearing problem, you put on a hearing aid, but there was no, there was no equivalent of a hearing aid for social and emotional communication.
And you talk about developing or asking yourself the question, could you develop an emotional hearing aid?
Right.
Which is a really fascinating concept.
Right, and so we prototyped, this was way back before Google Glass, we prototyped a set of glasses with a little camera that faced outwards, and it could detect, you know, any number of faces in the crowd, and it was attached to a big laptop that we carried in a backpack. That was before the iPhone or, you know, smartphones. And it basically gave you real-time feedback through a Bluetooth headset on how the audience you're interacting with felt. Hmm. And it was a kludgy prototype. This was way back in 2005. But the idea was you could imagine how a piece of technology can augment not just your cognitive intelligence, but also your emotional intelligence.
How well developed is this science? The science, before we actually get into the current day work, talk a little bit about the science of just developing libraries and taxonomies of facial expressions that and how they reflect emotion.
So in the world of facial expressions, we have about 45 facial muscles that drive, you know, thousands of combinations of expressions. And this guy called Paul Ekman in the 70s, and his team, he's actually on the West Coast, published the facial action coding system. And he mapped every single facial muscle to an expression. So I'll give you an example. We can try this together. So action unit 12 is the zygomatic muscle, which is what you use when you smile. So try activating that. There you go. And then
that's facial unit 12.
12, yes. Action unit 4 is the corrugator muscle, which is the brow furrow, which you tend to do if you're angry or you're, you know, confused, concentrating. And so he developed a coding. So you had to go through 100 hours of training to become a certified fax coder. And then it took you about 5 minutes to code 1 minute of video. So you go in slow motion and you say, aha, I see action unit 12. And then you're a blink. So what we did is we took this and kind of used computer vision and machine learning to automate it.
I was so fascinated to find out that science existed. This FACS, the coding system.
Right.
Is part of the underlying basis for so much of this technology, isn't
Absolutely
it?
Absolutely right.
But that existed before any kind of high-powered computing could
Correct.
Be applied to the whole area, though, didn't it?
Correct. That was kind of the foundation work for how you would objectively score facial expressions. Hmm.
Let's talk about how you then went on to move out of Cambridge and away from your early research and to MIT, and what happened to you there?
So I got to MIT Media Lab, and the lab is quite interesting in that a lot of the funding comes from industry, not from government funding. My particular project, which was the kind of the glasses, the emotional hearing aid, was funded by the National Science Foundation, and that's what brought me over to the US. But at the lab, twice a year, we had this event where we would invite all our industry sponsors, and we called it Demo or Die. So you had to show a demo of your technology. So I stood there, you know, twice a year, between 2006 and 2009, and I'd demo our glasses. And they, you know, and these sponsors, which were, you know, Fortune 100 companies, you know, Procter & Gamble would say, well, have you thought about using this in advertising testing? Or Toyota would say, well, we really want to use the technology for monitoring drivers. And I kept a log of all the different use cases. And after about 3 years and 20 of those, my co-founder is Professor Rosalind Picard. She's an MIT professor.
Yes.
So we both went into our director's office and we were like, Frank, you know, we need 10 more research students because we're ignoring all these sponsors. And he looked at us and he said, this is not a research problem anymore. This is a commercialization opportunity.
Which is very much one way of thinking at the MIT Media Lab.
Right.
Yeah.
And so he said, you basically need to decide if you want to spin out.
What did your glasses do? Before we talk about the spin-off and your relationship to Rosalind Picard, can you just talk a little bit about what the state of the art was at that point?
So at that point, we were the NSF funding was it was a partnership between MIT and a school for autism based in Rhode Island,
and autism is in the picture.
Very autism focused, and the idea was to build these glasses and like deploy them at the school and track if the kids' social behaviors improved, and we were seeing a lot of positive feedback from the kids and the parents. So the project was going well, but it was also coming to an end, and we were at a crossroad. I think at the time, I was realizing that in research or academia in general, you build these prototypes, but you never actually bring them to market at scale.
Yeah.
And so I was intrigued by the idea of starting a company to really kind of, you know, make this ubiquitous.
Yeah. The innovator's dilemma. How do you take it and then build it at scale?
Right.
Very brave of you. So how did you decide that this is what you really wanted to do?
I think I was intrigued by this idea of, like, let's take this technology, which I feel very passionate about, and figure out a way to really change how people do things because of this technology, and like improve how people connect and communicate. Mm-hmm. And then being at MIT, of course, once you express an interest in spinning out, like there's a swarm of people who help you
ready
with
to
the
help.
Process.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's show everybody what it actually does. Shall we do that?
Yes. Let's
All
do
right.
a live
so we,
demo.
We have a live demo. We're flying without a wire here, folks. So.
John's
Hang
gonna
on.
Be my guinea pig.
Yes, I'm.
Let's see how expressive you are. So this is an app on an iPad. You can actually download it. It's in the App Store as well as Google Play. It's called AffectXMe, or you could just search for Affectiva. It uses the camera on the device.
And please don't clear the auditorium because my face is on the wall over there.
Okay, so you can see what's happening on the monitors here. So first of all, it's found John's face right away, even though he's not in the training set. And it's recognized his, so it associates you, identified you as male. You're also wearing glasses.
Right.
And you're smiling.
I'm smiling. So joy. I'm getting joy.
Bars.
A lot of joy right now.
A lot of joy.
Yeah.
But it reads about 20 different facial expressions and 8 emotional states. We're only showing 6 here just not to overload the screen. But let's see how good you are.
All right, so now brow furrow.
There you go, so brow furrow, yeah. That's action unit 4. Mm. Do you wanna try eyebrow raise? Yeah.
Immediately. Surprise. emotes laughter is not on here, I think it should be. All right, so lip suck.
That's an interesting one because that's like what people do when they're pondering or sometimes it's an emotion regulation, like if people are stressed, we often see that expression.
Suck in the lips like that, okay, so.
And then nose wrinkle is what we often, that's often a disgust expression.
Yeah.
You're pretty good at this.
Now what's the little emoji?
So we take a the combination of your facial expressions, and then we map it to your most dominant emoji. And you can try things like looking surprised, but also you can try sticking your tongue out if you want to, and we can see if that.
I like that one. Now I'm going to talk while it's still on my face. Uh-huh. Let's talk for a minute about all these white dots and what they're doing in real time.
So the way the technology works is it uses computer vision and machine learning. And so we've collected millions of these facial expressions that we use to train the algorithm. So first step, it needs to find a face. And it can actually do multiple faces. So if we pointed, I can stick my face in the camera and it'll track me as well. But then once it finds a face, it triangulates on the main feature points on your face, your eyebrows, your eyes, your mouth, your lips. And that helps the algorithm kind of align the face information. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then what it's doing is it's looking at every single pixel on your face for texture changes and color combinations. Like if you smile, you see teeth. Or if you do a brow furrow, there's all these wrinkles happening here. And that's what it uses to determine what the expression is. So if you wanted to tell the difference between, say, a smile and a smirk, you would feed the algorithm, tens of thousands of examples of people smiling, tens of thousands of examples of people smirking. Mm-hmm. And then it would learn that the difference is in the lips, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that's a smirk, that's a smile. Yeah.
Yeah, right. Great. One other thing, then I'm going to put this down. It's so much fun. This is not a tricked out iPad. This is just a standard. I could go down to the Apple Store and get this, and standard camera and all
right,
of that.
So right.
It's just doing all this on a device that any of us could have.
Exactly. So Boise was responsible for taking all these machine learning algorithms that run in the cloud and shrinking them so that they could run in real time on the device, which was no easy feat. But this is not connected to the internet. It's doing everything on the device.
Just on the device. It's all resident right there.
Exactly.
It's very cool. Now, there's a very famous face in history, the inscrutable face that we've all wondered about. Haven't you ever wondered what the Mona Lisa was really thinking? Well, tell us what you think the Mona Lisa is saying to us.
So I'll caveat this a bit.
Of course.
Facial expressions and expressions of emotion in general are dynamic. So it's actually quite hard to quantify how people are feeling just from a single image. We can do it. The algorithm can do it. But it is more accurate if you have you can see the emotions unfold over time. Of course, we don't get that here. We did find that there's a very subtle smile. So we can code the intensity of an expression, and it goes from A to E, where E is like a humongous smile, like the one you had. And A is a very subtle smile, just a tiny lip, corner pull. And that's what we're seeing with Mona Lisa.
Okay. So the belief for a long time that she is giving this little subtle smile. Subtle.
Which actually we did, we have about 500,000 smile instances in our database. And we did a data mining exercise where we wanted to cluster the different types of smiles, and we found that there's at least five different types of smiles, and this particular subtle smile we found was very pervasive in Asia, in Asian populations. Like almost a lot of people had this subtle smile as a baseline. It's a social smile. It's not a happiness smile. It's more of a politeness social smile.
Fascinating. The mechanism of how you capture all of these expressions and then work on them and code them and decode them. How does that work? How does the company actually pull that off? Because it's a stunning number of frames and people and countries that you're working with now.
Right. We ask for people's permission. So you get a link, you click on it, we ask for your permission to turn the camera on. If you say yes, camera turns on, you watch the video, we collect your response. And then we process it through the technology.
Okay.
And so all that data, part of it becomes training data and part of it becomes validation data. And we have a team of expert fax coders who provide the ground truth for the algorithm.
So this fax coding, this is a thing. This is a skill that is taking this database that you talked about and is applying it to this very large database that you're processing.
Exactly.
Is that a hard thing to get to be, a fax coder?
I mean, it takes a fair amount of training and patience, too, because
yeah.
you're staring at these videos, you know, day in, day out. It's a fundamental piece of our pipeline to train the algorithm.
Well, now that we've seen it in action and we understand a little more about how it's done, let's talk about how you started the company to begin with and how you set it up, because it's not a Silicon Valley startup.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, we're so commonly associating the word startup with Silicon Valley. I did want to point that out because you're based in Waltham,
Boston.
Massachusetts.
We actually moved to Boston.
You moved to Boston.
Downtown
so now you're in Boston.
Yeah.
And startup often connotes something that is really recent, and it's fairly recent because you started it in 2009.
Nine.
Right. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about what that early period was like.
So we spun out with this vision of kind of building artificial emotional intelligence. And our thesis was, you know, if you look at human intelligence, your EQ predicts, you know, how likable you are, how persuasive you are, how successful you are in your professional and personal life. And we felt that with technology becoming a lot more conversational and interactive, that was, you know, EQ is equally important for our devices and our technologies. So that's the big vision. We see a world where, you know, in 3 to 5 years down the line, all our devices are gonna have an emotion chip that can respond to your emotions.
All of our devices, our phones, our iPads,
our fridges, you know, our cars.
Mm.
And a lot of this is unfolding. We are piloting some of this technology in a lot of these areas.
I want to hear more about that. I do, especially cars. That I can just imagine what it would be like to have a car respond to your emotions. But mm-hmm. let's talk about the.
Yeah.
You saw my face. I mean, let's talk about the startup though, and actually getting it started and becoming commercial with something that is, when you see it, you can say, "Aha, I get it." But a lot of people may not have really got it in the beginning.
Right. When we spun out, a lot of the questions we were getting were like, what? Like emotion recognition? Like, what is that? And like, why would you ever do that? Like, I think we had to do a lot of selling, you know, selling the case for emotion AI. But I'd say
Did people really even understand what that is, emotional AI or emotional intelligence? I mean, did anybody say to you, oh, emotional intelligence, that's just kind of, AI, I understand, but that other thing, no.
I think the question was more like why? Why would you ever need that?
Mm.
And also how? Like, what do you mean? Like, you can capture people's emotions? It's almost an oxymoron because emotions are very personal, and but now we can quantify it. So there was a lot of, I would say, as a company, we've helped seed the market, we've helped create the market. When we spun out, there were, you know, very few other players in this space, and now there's a lot more. And you know, with my MIT hat on, I actually think that that's awesome that we helped spur a category. But our challenge is that there are so many use cases for the technology. That's both kind of the opportunity, but that it's a challenge for a young startup to, you know, to not struggle, but grapple with which areas are going to be the killer, you know, what's going to be the killer app.
Who understood it first? The sort of independent evaluator who saw this first, an investor, a company, who said, now I get it.
So our early investor was an advertising conglomerate called WPP.
Sure.
They're kind of like a Nielsen competitor. And they saw the use. So they were, you know, most of the brands they work with want to understand the emotional engagement of the consumer. And the way they did that was, you know, they asked you. And that's, of course, very biased. And so they knew that they wanted this kind of visceral subconscious reaction to content or to a product concept. And so there, that was a very clear kind of product market fit.
Mm-hmm.
And I also think that they both saw the opportunity and they acted on it. So that was one of the earliest integrations we did, and it's pretty successful. We're in 75 countries around the world. We work with a third of the Fortune 500 companies. So that's been a very successful commercialization path.
Have you found in your research that we're all always responding, that we're constantly changing? No matter what we're doing, we're responding to something.
That was the first question we had to answer. So when WPP approached us, you know, and they said, okay, cool technology, but people are watching ads at home at midnight. Like, they're not going to be emotive, right? And so the very first test we had to do was to kind of validate the hypothesis that people emote even if there's no other human being on the other end of the line. And that's absolutely true. We've seen people now, in driving contexts. We've just finished a pilot with a big automotive company in Japan. So we had cameras in Tokyo and in Boston. Fun to see people driving in Boston. It's pretty sometimes stressful. And you can see all these expressions on people's faces. So you emote even if there's no other human being watching.
What's the most difficult thing to teach your system to do, as even as the AI capabilities improve so quickly?
I'm particularly fascinated in the applications of this back to mental health, which is where I started this research. I'm particularly intrigued around, anxiety and depression. So there's some academic research that shows that both your tone of voice and your facial expressions can be soft biomarkers and early flags for depressive patients. But there hasn't been any research that's been done at scale. And so if anybody in the audience is interested in exploring this with us, I do think there's a lot of potential, because you're on your device.
Right. In
our research, we found that people check their phones 15 times an hour. That's a lot.
That is a lot.
And that's an opportunity to get an emotion data point on you, every time you check in. And I think that technology can be very powerful to a flag or understand that you're deviating from your baseline. And it could, and get you help. And the help could be just to flag it to you as a person. Mm-hmm. It could be a personal assistant that knows you really well and can say, John, you don't look too happy today. Like, what's going on? Do you want to? How many people have seen Her, the movie? Yeah, so some version of that. Or it could flag it to a clinician or a partner or a parent.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm intrigued about that. And we need a lot more data to be able to quantify that in a accurate way.
What more do you need?
We need data, from a healthy population as well as a depressive population, so that we can build predictive models that identify, okay, these are the biomarkers. We know, like, droopy eyelids, dampened facial expressions. There's also a delay in responses. Like, all these we know are red flags, but we don't have enough data to build accurate models.
And is that because it's just difficult to move the technology into a community of people who are responding that way so that you could get the data that you need?
Yes, I mean, you asked about the early market and the advertising research space. They moved fast.
Sure.
And the barriers to entry were, just really low. Whereas in healthcare, it's a lot more risk averse as a market.
Yeah. And have you shown it to clinicians and others who work with these people? And are they intrigued? Have they given you encouragement to say, yeah, I really would like to be a part of this?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think there is an understanding that this could be very powerful, for diagnosis, but also for evaluating the effectiveness of treatments. You could, again, imagine, you're undergoing a certain treatment. It could be, medication-based or cognitive behavior, therapy-based. The technology can quantify if you're getting better or not and can do that in real time, as opposed to the model where you check in with a clinician or a doctor once a month and you spend most of your time trying to self-report, if you're depressed or not, or if you're suicidal. Like, in suicide assessment, the gold standard is self-report. The analogy I like to give is you don't walk into a doctor's office today and they ask you what's your blood pressure. They just measure it. But in mental health, the gold standard is still a self-report.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like technology, you know, it's time for technology to help us be more objective.
And in autism, there's a wonderful story that was told in that same article about you were working with a young boy who was actually hiding behind his tablet, right? He didn't want to see you. Can you tell a little bit about that and what actually happened?
Yeah, so this boy, so in autism, a lot of individuals on the autism spectrum find facial expressions very overwhelming because of course there's a lot happening. And so they often tend to avoid face contact or eye contact at all. And so he was using the device almost as a barrier, as a barrier to looking at people's faces. But as we kind of deployed the technology more and more, he very slowly kind of lowered it. And I remember the very first time he made eye contact with me, I was like, oh, you're looking at me, you know? So we could quantify that.
Yeah.
We could see that it's kind of helping bridge the communication gap.
Yeah, and what a great moment for him to learn that.
And I remember his mom was there in the room, and she got pretty emotional.
Oh, I bet she did. All right, let's talk about cars now,
okay.
Because that's something we can all relate to, I think. How is it being experimented with? How do you see it being deployed, this technology in cars and driving?
So there's a lot, like generally speaking, the trend is towards conversational interfaces. And it's this idea that you're going to have a dialogue with your device which includes your car. What we're seeing a specific interest in is, you know, eventually all cars will be autonomous, but there will be a period of a number of years where it's semi-autonomous and the car needs to relinquish control at some point in time back to the driver. But it needs to know if the driver is paying attention or not. Is he or she awake? Are they watching a movie? Are they texting? And so understanding the mental state of the driver is becoming really critical. So there's a safety aspect to it. But then there's also the idea of a car becoming more of a concierge, like an infotainment vehicle that can personalize the experience. You know, you walk in and based on your mood, the lighting changes or the music's personalized. And again, you can collect all that information based on both your expressions and your tone of voice. So,
You know, it's interesting to use the phrase conversational interface because that is how it's referred to today. It's kind of the state of the art. But all of us are initiating the conversations now.
Right.
We're talking to Siri. We're saying Alexa. We're saying, okay, Google.
Right.
But you're talking about a device actually initiating the conversation to us before we even know we need to have a conversation.
Right, and I think it's about also knowing when to initiate the conversation.
Like because it's looking at you and recognizing it in
right.
some way.
Right.
Yeah.
And if you think about our conversations with a Siri or an Alexa, it's very one way. So you say, Alexa, what's the weather? She'll say it is blah blah blah, and then that's it. There's no back and forth like.
It's true. There is no conversation.
There's no conversation.
Yeah.
And it's very transactional. And so as these interfaces become more relational, they need to know that, she gave you the wrong answer and you're kind of annoyed. And it needs to say, okay, I'm sorry. Shall I try something different?
Uh-huh.
Or it looks like I didn't, or it could
or you
tell
can
a joke.
At, look at your face and say,
right.
You didn't seem to like that answer very much.
Exactly.
Yeah. Is it possible that there are aspects to this that you know that we don't know yet? Have you discovered things about the way these interfaces, this sort of technology, picks up on you or understands you or discovers things that have surprised you as an application you didn't even know could be thought of?
I mean, I think one of the things that I found really fascinating is we did a cross-cultural study of all the data we collected, and we looked at gender differences. So by and large, we found that expressions are universal. Like a smile is a smile everywhere. But there are cultural rules across the world that depict when you invoke a smile or an expression or not. So we found that in Asia, people are more cautious about, you know, sharing negative emotions. We found that, for instance, the Latin Americans are the most expressive compared to, East Asians. Uh-huh. But we also found that Japanese people are just as expressive as Americans if it's in the context of their homes versus, you know, in the presence of strangers. So we were able to tease apart, like, what those display rules are and when do they get invoked. Uh-huh. We also found that women are more expressive than men, which is intuitive. Yeah. Now we have data to prove it. But then these differences are culturally specific. So in the U.S., we found that women smile 30% or 40% more than men. In France and Germany, women smile 25% more. And in the U.K., there was no difference between men and women. So. We don't know why.
That's so interesting. So what else have you found out that's culturally bound in this
I think our biggest takeaway is that people want to share emotions if you create the right context. So if you make it overly awkward or there's no trust, that's another, you know, if there's no trust with the interface or no trust in the context, then people will mask their emotions very quickly. Mm-hmm. And so we've always wanted to create an environment where people felt safe to be expressive.
Have you encountered that phenomenon that the tenant that the act of observing someone changes their behavior because they're being observed? Is that been an obstacle that you've had to overcome?
We've seen that in our early research, or, you know, in advertising, for instance, and then we very quickly said, okay, we do not want the moderator in the room because that changes your experience. Mm.
What industry or area have you most hoped to work with that is reluctant to take this up, or maybe you just haven't cracked it yet?
Education is one where I think it's also really has very high potential. So, not a lot of education is migrating online, but there's a lot of online learning, and I think that's awesome because it democratizes access to education. But it's not really working because it has no sense of whether you're confused or engaged or frustrated or bored. And so there's a very high drop-off rate with these online learning systems. I think I heard that only 5% of students actually complete, you know, online courses, which is really, really, really low.
It is quite low, yeah.
And I feel like a personalized learning, like a learning companion that knows you and can see that, okay, you're losing interest now, and it can just tell you, okay, it looks like you're losing interest. Let's go do something else and come back in a few minutes.
I'll talk a little bit about the technology and then how open the platform is for people to develop on. You've seen, I mean, it's amazing the rise of computing power between 2005 and 2017. Mm-hmm. In the era of Moore's Law, 12 years is an eternity. How has the technology improved, and how has it changed your ability now to do what Affectiva is doing now?
Yeah, a few things. So definitely the ubiquity of cameras and just the camera sensors are becoming a lot more sophisticated, and you can run, you know, they're on devices. They're really everywhere. And that has helped the scale and the deployment of the technology. Mm-hmm. So we don't have to worry about the hardware piece of it. It's already there. Deep learning, so the rise of deep learning, that's definitely transformed how we think about the problem and the accuracy. So just by moving from a traditional machine learning approach to training these models to deep learning, we were able to see, you know, a 10-point improvement in accuracy. So that's pretty powerful.
Now, how has deep learning affected it directly? Can you talk a little bit about the shift from this contrast that you made between machine learning and deep learning?
So with deep learning, it's very data hungry, but we luckily have a lot of data. And so with the other approach, so we used to use support vector machines if there are any machine learning people here, and we found that the improvement in accuracy tapered off. Like we could feed it more data and we could see that an improvement in accuracy, but it very quickly tapered off. Whereas with deep learning, the more data you give it, you have to be smart about what data like how to sample the data. But we haven't hit that ceiling yet. We're just continuing to see an improvement in accuracy.
And are you doing this out of Boston? Is all your technology based there, or is it in other places?
We're mostly based out of Boston. We have a few people remote, but we also have a satellite office in Cairo, where we do a lot of the video labeling.
Let's talk about how developers get involved with you. Are you doing all your own development? Are there app developers who, or will there be?
So, about two and a half years ago, we realized that as a startup, we can't really explore all the different use cases. We were just getting so much inbound interest all over the place. And so we made kind of a strategic decision to shrink everything, you know, to run on mobile. And then we packaged the core emotion engine as SDKs that run, you know, on iOS, Linux, Android, Unity, Raspberry Pi. And we put it out there, and we basically just tell people, you know, have at it. Like, go build something awesome with this technology. Because we don't want people to spend, you know, months and months rebuilding that core engine when they could be just applying it and integrating it to create a new user experience, whether that's a game or an interactive kiosk. The technology is really used broadly. So one example was Avocados for Mexico. they had a big booth at South by Southwest this year where you could walk up to the booth, smile, and depending on your happiness score, you get a personalized avocado dish. So I was like, we would have never done this, right?
Yeah.
It's a super creative application.
Now, as they're collecting facial images, do you have an ability to add that data to your database?
Yeah. Yes, we're continuously growing that database. That's key.
Do you ever see that stopping?
No, I don't think so, because right now, I kind of liken the state of the technology to a toddler. Like, it can do the basic emotions. But it can't do, like, I'm very intrigued by, like, what do people look like when they're inspired? Or jealous, or proud. Like, nobody's systematically looked at the facial expressions of, you know, inspiration or pride or some of these more kind of nuanced, complex emotions. And I think this technology can really help us answer these basic science questions. Uh-huh. So we're not done. The other area where we're investing a lot of our effort now is combining multiple modalities. So to understand people's emotional intent, only 10% comes from the words you're actually saying. 30 to 35% is in how you're saying those words, and the rest is facial expressions and gestures. So we've got the facial expressions part. We don't do gestures, and I do a lot of gestures. but you could train an algorithm to detect head nods and, you know, like shoulder shrugs. And then we're starting to explore tone of voice as well, and then combining all these to get a better picture of how you're feeling. That's the next frontier of research.
And does the data increase exponentially as you start to put all of that together?
Yes.
Because we as humans do that very, very rapidly, don't we?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is there a point at which you see the ability of the engine to run this, to move as quickly as a human perception might run?
I actually think so. Yeah, I think so. I also think, you know, we do this subconsciously. Like, you can tell if somebody's being insincere, but you don't exactly know why, right? Like, you know that, okay, this person's probably lying, but you can't exactly triangulate why. The machine is very good, or the algorithm is very good at detecting, like, super fast, super nuanced expressions, especially if you have, like, a camera that runs at 30 or 60 frames a second. It's getting all these frames and it's detecting these, you know, an eye squint or a twitch or, you know, a very subtle lip corner pull. Like, it can do all that pretty fast, and it can do it, you know, if we had the right camera pointed at this audience, it could track all that in real time, whereas, you know, I can't do that in real time, right?
No, you can't, but you could go back and look at it, couldn't you, and figure out
That's right.
how the evening went for us and for everyone else here. So why don't you just talk a little bit about your philosophy about the privacy part.
So when Roz and I spun out, we had one more person with us, so we were a team of three, and we sat around Roz's dining table and we said, okay, like, what is just non-negotiable? And we kind of decided that it was very important for us that people consented, like people knew that this technology was there and that their data was being collected. So opt-in and consent were key for us. And that meant that, for instance, we don't do security applications. We've stayed away from that use case, even though we do get approached.
I'm sure you do.
I feel like aligning with the consumer or with the user who's sharing the data, there has to be value in it for the person. And that value could be monetary, like in advertising research, you get paid to, you know, watch the ad. Or it could be a social value, like a better experience when you're talking to Amazon Alexa because it knows how you're feeling.
But I
feel like there has to be value for the user who's sharing that data.
I mean, did you have to look down the road at where this all might end up someday and say, you know, we think that might happen out there and we're not so sure we want to be a part of that?
Yeah, so the other area is pornography or like sex robots.
Yeah.
That's probably going to be a big market, but I don't know if we're going to play it.
Non-negotiable.
I
hear you. All right. You just touched on this. This is so good. That I get questions. You can see that little asterisk. Lots of people asked about this, so we get a couple of representative questions.
Cool.
This one is about lie detection and whether you've been approached for that, and are there other, apart from pornography, other ethically questionable applications?
Right. Yeah. So the kind of the filter is: can we get people's consent? Do they know? Can we be transparent that this technology is collecting this information? And do people getting clear opt-in? And that's in our, like, if you're downloading our SDK from our website, that's very clear. You know, we would revoke your license if you use this in a use case without people's consent. Uh-huh. Lie detection is challenging, actually. It is very hard to tell if a person's lying. You need a lot more context. You need to know what is the context of the conversation. You know, is there a dissonance between the facial expression, the tone of voice, and then the words that are being said? And we're not there yet. It's a complex issue, but also we're not necessarily focused on it.
Yeah. How does an application like yours handle intentional deception or emotional manipulation or the ability of someone who's really good at regulating their facial expression from being discovered that they're really good at doing that?
I would say at the moment the technology is pretty naive. Like if you decide to completely have a poker face, that's what the algorithm's going to pick up on. With the exception of, so when people lie or are being deceptive, there's these leaks or micro expressions that kind of, you know, that will leak subconsciously.
Mm. Leak, it's an interesting word to apply to it.
Right. okay. But you find that if people are lying, these like very quick, very nuanced expressions, and most non-expert humans will totally miss them, right? Like unless you're a trained expert or really paying attention.
Yeah.
You may not see, you know, these eye twitches or, again, like, lip movements. And the technology could pick those up.
Pick that up. That's really fascinating. A lot of people ask this question. What do you see as the potential risk or downside of emotional AI? And you've talked a little bit about it, but could you just elaborate on that a bit?
I mean, I think it's both the power and the fear. So the big thesis is that when you are more emotionally intelligent, you can persuade people better. And that's true for humans. It's true for my 8-year-old son. He knows the right moment to ask me for those Pokemon cards. And I think that's going to be true for emotion AI, like machines that can read your emotions and sense the right person to persuade you to change your behavior. And that could be losing more weight, you know, sleeping better, not eating that tub of ice cream because you've already had a lot of sugar, right?
Yeah.
But it could also be used to manipulate you in ways that maybe we don't want as a society. So I could imagine politicians, you know, monitoring in real time how people are responding to their messages and kind of tweaking that in real time. And that may or may not be a good, you know, that may not be a good thing.
It's a very honest answer. And I have to say your openness about this is just really wonderful. I think if someone who's working in such a sensitive area to have that kind of your own quality of emotional intelligence, I think is really terrific.
Well, I think it's actually important, and that's why, you know, we prioritize these, you know, engaging with the public, because I think we collectively are going to come up with the guidelines or best practices for what, you know, what is right and what isn't about this technology. And unless we're very open about what it can and can't do, we're not going to come up with an optimal decision. So, or focus our efforts in the right place, right? Like, we could, you know, collectively we could spend our time building lie detectors, or we could go solve depression, right? And I'd rather spend my mind share on that.
It's clearly where your passion is. I want to talk about this concern. This is another aspect of the privacy issue, about all this data that's being collected about all of us now, mm-hmm. in ways we know about and some we don't. Being in these massive repositories out there, and the possibility that someone, for whatever purpose, might hack them, might get into them. How can everyone involved in this safeguard this really personal data that is being accumulated about us?
Yeah, so we have all the security kind of systems in place. So in fact, actually, we do not keep track of the person's identity. So we have your facial expressions, but we don't know that it belongs to you. And we try to decouple that information. So that's one way you could do it. You could also, once we process the face videos, we're more interested in the features and the emotional readouts, more so than the actual features. But I think, I mean, outside of our data, right? Like, you're right that there's so much data being collected about us. And I think as consumers, we make maybe an informed or uninformed decision. You know, we weigh the value versus the risk, and...
Mm-hmm. Well, we do opt in,
right.
And you're giving us that opportunity to
right.
opt in, but
right.
maybe we're not always thinking about
yeah.
the long-term ramifications of opting
right.
into all of these.
But that's true of, you know, social networks, and, you know, I look at my teenage daughter and the amount of information that she and her friends share, and it's
yeah.
like, no, you don't want that out there, right?
Yeah. Autism is where you began.
Mm-hmm.
If you could wave a magic wand now and apply this technology to your experience working with autistic children in particular, what would you have it do?
I think it would be awesome if this was kind of packaged into a cool, I don't want to say prosthetic device, but a social training, you know, technology that fades in the background and but it's helping these kids really connect. So we worked a lot with teenagers who just wanted to have a girlfriend, and they couldn't tell if girls were interested in them or were being sarcastic.
You're going to make $1 billion.
On that, right? Is that the killer app? Yeah.
It may be.
Right? Right. Actually, we often get told that dating is the killer app.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can see that, yeah. There'd be a lot of opting in for that application. And, you know, finally, you've talked about your children a lot tonight. And how do you see the world that they're going to live in 20 years from now, when not just your technology, but all the things that you get exposed to just in doing what you do starts to really kick in?
You know, there's a kind of a counter argument that we are, you know, with the technology we're building, we're kind of inspiring people to even rely even more on their devices. I would say that I just don't see a world where, you know, I look at my daughter and, you know, and the only way I could get a hold of her if she's not physically here is through her phone. Like, mm-hmm. she won't answer a call. Maybe she'll text me back. I don't know. So I feel like technology is not going to go away. And so, given that, then I think we need the next iteration of these interfaces to be a lot more, you know, smarter and socially aware and adept. Because I don't see us going back. Like, I don't see us not relying on our phones or not having smarter cars. I mean, even connected homes, right? Like, Yeah. And I do think that there is a version of this technology that enables people to connect in better ways. So the example I like to give is, like, I have, I don't know, like 5,000 friends on Facebook. So it's helped me connect with a lot more people, but the quality of that connection is really poor, right? And I think with our technology, it can augment communication so that, you know, people who are in my close circle of friends can, you know, can find, you know, can know with my consent that I'm having a bad day and maybe reach out and, you know, and check in. And you can't do that today. You have to be explicit. Like, you have to be very explicit about how you're feeling and seek help. Whereas I think it can mimic like a live experience where you walk into the living room and your partner says, "Ooh, like, what happened at work?" Right? Because they can sense. Like, my mom lives in Cairo. And I'll just pick up the phone and I'll say, "Hi, mom." She's like, "What's wrong?" Like, she knows right away that there's something right.
Yeah.
So it would, you know, can we build technology that knows you that well and can with your permission share that level of, you know, like, depth of feelings with people you care about?
This is fascinating. Thank you so much for being here tonight.
That was Rana El Khaliyoubi, CEO and co-founder of Affectiva. Next time, you'll hear from Tony Fadell, who was crucial in creating the iPod and iPhone. He also co-founded smart thermostat company Nest. Thanks for tuning in to this episode of CHM Live Radio. This podcast is produced by Lauren Miyamoto and me, Chanel Lauren. John Plute composed our intro music, and transitional music is provided by Lee Rosevere. You can learn more about our events and the museum at computerhistory.org.
This program was brought to you by the Computer History Museum.